This question of why ethics is the sort of the beginning of the path, I think has been an interesting one for me for some time, actually. I was just chatting with Priscilla about it in the break. So I know sometimes in the past I've kind of, if I've been feeling miserable, and then I've brought to mind the fact that ethics is the basis of the practice, then I thought, well, I'm feeling miserable, so I must have done something very unethical. And then I just feel even worse. End up, sort of banging my head against the wall. The kind of, sometimes I think the relationship between difficult feelings and an ethical practice isn't always so easy to figure out. But I think, I think the key for me is sort of recognizing the ethical dimension in terms of my relationship with myself. I think, I don't know about you, but I think, it's kind of easy for me in a way to think about my ethical behavior towards others. Less easy sometimes, I think, to see the kind of self-harming behaviors, which have so kind of deeply ingrained in our self-view. I think if we're working with the state of remorse, which in Buddhism is essentially a neutral state, although there's a little bit to say about that. I think, make sure that we're kind of also working with a recognition of how we've treated ourselves in the past and maybe in the present. I think if a sense of remorse arises in that context, that can really help us to reorient our self-care help to shift some of our sort of self-defeating behaviours. So why practice ethics at all? I suppose, you'll have noticed when we do the precepts, we talk about the purification element of our ethical practice. So we're purifying our body through acts of generosity, with stillness, simplicity, and contentment. These are the body precepts. We're purifying our speech through the practice of truthful speech, and our minds through the practice of mindfulness, abstinence from intoxication. Very much that sense for me of our ethical awareness being a having a purifying effect on our kind of toxicity, if you want to use that rather contemporary term. There's a rather nice book by an order member, Vimala Sara, which she calls Detox Your Heart. And I think, for me, that's a very kind of redolent phrase. That makes a lot of sense to me. Because of the experiences that we've had in our lives, particularly possibly in our early lives, there's a certain kind of what Sangharaja calls a quantum of negativity start kind of gets accrued in the heart, or in the heart mind, that can come out in a whole number of different ways. Paramananda just refers to it as our head damage, which has a certain ring to it as well. But I think it's head and heart, of course. So our head damage, our unhelpful behavior towards other people and towards ourselves, I think, generally arises out of a wound in the heart. So, and when that's when we're in the kind of grip of our sort of psychological neurotic behaviours, our kind of narrow self view, our self clinging, then yeah, we tend not to have a kind of, our ethical sensitivity kind of gets shut down because we're kind of, we're trying so hard to kind of figure out how we can get what we think we want that we start to forget that actually, you know, we're all in it together. And yeah, but there's, so this aspect of purification in the practice, and I think, yeah, that ethical practice does kind of, it lightens the load. Yeah, it kind of literally kind of lightens the heart. I think, I don't know if any of you found that in the meditation itself, that, you know, bringing in some of the positive precepts as I was dropping in them actually had a sort of a buoying effect on the heart. Anyone catch that? Yeah. There's a few people nodding. Good. There's this whole interesting thing in Buddhism about, as well, about how, you know, we in the West we've got all these kind of, this whole fine idea of, you know, the psychological, our psychological problems. And we spend a lot of time and we spend a lot of money trying to sort out our own and other people's psychological problems. And that's fraught with comedy cul-de-sacs and the what's called often called the interpretive quagmire. So the way in which the interpretive method, which is what many psychotherapeutic methods are, essentially ends us up getting kind of bogged down. Buddhism really very kind of naturally just neatly kind of cuts through all that. Just saying, you know, that ethical practice is the way to sort out our psychological states. I think I remember sort of hearing that when I first came along, and I mean, at the time I was a social worker and I was a family therapist, and I was very much kind of embedded in the in sort of post-Freudian psychotherapeutic idea of humanity, and it was like I couldn't really make sense of it at all. I'm still very intrigued by the psychological model. Perhaps particularly more now the more sort of Jungian archetypal psychology rather than the more sort of ego based one. But also, yeah, I think just noticing, developing that kind of a more sensitive embodied state in myself, and noticing how ethical practice does actually, as we, some of us experience, has a kind of buoying effect on the heart. It does bring joy into my experience. So yes, so and just, you know, so I was talking with Joseph earlier, and just sort of saying, you know, again, recognizing just, you know, how much of the ethical unskillfulness is directed towards ourselves. So really, really just notice how much of that we may end up doing. So remorse, yeah. So I don't know. Did anyone get it when just at the end of the practice, when I just invited people to get a sense of the sensation of remorse? Did that? Anyone get anything there?
I did. Yes. What did you get? Sort of heaviness.
Okay.
My heart, which is strange, because I thought, you know, heavy-hearted was sadness.
Okay.
as well.
How do you define remorse?
I haven't. How do I define remorse? I don't know. Did you get a sense?
I have a sort of vague idea, but I don't know if I'm.
Hang on, I've got it on my phone.
All right.
Cool. Phone a friend. Phone a friend.
Is this the Buddhist?
No.
Definition.
It's not true.
Remorse is an emotional expression of personal regret felt by a person after they have committed an act which they deem to be shameful, hurtful, or violent. Personal regret.
It's like guilt.
Closely allied to guilt and self-directed resentment.
Right. Thank you.
It's a bit strong.
It's a bit strong. Yeah. I don't know. What would you say is the Buddhist take on remorse?
There's a positive version of it, which is simply that sense of regret that gives you the impetus to decide to sort of mend your ways in a way, I suppose. If you've been doing destructive things, then a feeling of actually I'm fed up with that and I'd like to be different in the future.
I mean, it comes from, I think it's got that connection with biting, hasn't it? So it's to kind of mordant, so it's got that kind of biting back somehow. Yeah, sort of back on ourselves. But let's just stay with the difficult. Well, let's just stay with the feeling, actually. No, actually, let's not stay with the feeling. Kaukritya is the Sanskrit term, and yeah, interestingly, it's the same word as anxiety. Yeah, so Thomas, you said it felt like a weight on the heart. I mean, you saw on the bit of paper there, I wrote it's a kind of an affliction of the heart, but when we talk about restlessness and anxiety as what we call a hindrance to meditation, it's the same word. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. So it's kind of suggesting that it's got this kind of we can't settle with it.
I actually felt a kind of almost like a chemical reaction in my body. Actually felt some sort of unpleasant chemical reaction in my body just thinking about.
Okay. Yeah. And you're gesturing towards the gut as well, which suggests a kind of...
Sort of almost got that indigestion.
Fine.
But it's not very nice.
Okay. Did freedom from remorse remove the pain?
Yes.
Good. it's like Rennie's.
Yes. Yes. But I mean, it was quite definite.
Yeah.
I could say chemical. I don't know how else...
Metabolic. Yeah. Well, then
it's interesting because I would normally associate regret with something going on in my stomach rather than my heart.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
Because it's sadness in the heart.
Yeah, that's right.
It is a kind of sadness, isn't it? But I suppose it has a sort of flavour that's just a bit different to
So I think, it's a very rich state, remorse. So I think it's got both. It's got that kind of quality of feeling a bit sick with ourselves, as you were suggesting, right? But it's also described as being the kind of the natural educator of the heart. So, yeah, that it's when we have a sense of remorse, if we can stay with it. So, typically what will happen is that it will generate anxiety, and then it becomes uncomfortable, and we want to then kind of get rid of it. Yeah. So anxiety is a sort of. Anxiety is a presentiment of a feeling that we don't want to have. So, you know, like there's something coming up, I don't want to look at it. So, in a way, our kind of nervous system generates anxiety as a means to kind of to stop us looking at what's difficult. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, when we're anxious, we're not actually in touch with our feelings because the feelings themselves are difficult. So it's a kind of defense. Anxiety is a kind of defense mechanism, you could say. But I think if we can sit with the anxiety and allow it to dissolve, you know, which is in a lot of ways what we're doing when we're meditating, somehow we can maybe sit. We can drop into some of those more visceral feelings that Thomas and Mariangela are describing, and I think that can be a very rich experience. But we'll look a little more at that. So, people familiar with the wheel and the spiral? Anyone put their hand up if they know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, the colours have gone a bit mad, but anyway. So here we've got a wheel, and it goes all the way around, apart from this area here where there's a gap. And from that gap comes a spiralling path. So these are the two paths of the spiritual life, actually, in a way. And this... this is the wheel of life. Some of you might have seen the image downstairs outside the shrine room. So, yeah, that's a depiction of our kind of all the sort of various mundane states that we exist in, from the gods to the hell states to the animal states, the hungry ghosts, etc., and the human realm. But around the outside of that wheel, there's also what we call the Nidana chain, which is the Buddha's kind of teaching of how individual consciousness operates. Very interesting. Have a look at it. We're not going to go into the detail of that, but there's one point on that wheel which is a very significant point. And as you can see, it's the one point on the wheel where there's a gap. So this gap is called the working ground of the spiritual life. So, anyone know what the gap is between?
Vedana is one, is it?
Yeah.
Sort of tone of a feeling. I can't remember the other.
Yeah, Vedana. Yeah. So, feeling sensation. So, yeah, on this, so we're going around clockwise. So before you get to the gap, you have Vedana, feeling sensation, which is either pleasant, painful, or neutral. Yeah. So it's kind of, again, it's going to be a very visceral experience. Yeah. It's either, or, or whatever. And that kind of deep... sort of primal impulses, in a way, are just happening all the time. You know, when we're moving to and forwards, and the mind is kind of shifting away and towards things. So then we have the gap. On the other side of the gap is craving or thirst. And once craving or thirst kicks in, basically we just carry on round the wheel like we always have done. Yeah. And up here you've got birth and death, so you know, this is, you go, okay, that's that lifetime done, and then you come round again. Boop. And then if we jump over the gap, which is quite often what we tend to do, you know, we have a feeling, and we just stick with our habitual response. So that person who we find difficult comes into the room, we look away, and we close down, and yeah, that's that life over, okay? And so you just carry on round. This is all our kind of, these are all our habits, and this is what Sangharakshita calls the reactive mind, as opposed to the spiral, which he describes as the creative mind. So the spiral starts from the gap, and that is the so-called spiritual path. That is what we think of as the evolving path, rather than the wheel, which is the revolving path. Yeah. So on the wheel, we're just going round and round at the same. So if this is a kind of spectrum of consciousness, you know, the wheel just goes round and round here. You get onto the spiral, and you're actually starting to go up the consciousness hierarchy, whatever. No, we're getting into heights and depths. But anyway, this is a path of refinement. Yeah. The wheel is a path of bondage. You could say. The spiral is a path of release. Particularly for me, the heart's release. It's one description of the spiritual path, which has always spoken to me, the heart's release. And you could say this is the path of psychological problems, and this is the path of spiritual solutions. Sangrajita, who's known for his terse aphorisms, somewhere has said, there are only spiritual solutions to psychological problems, which is, as in the case of aphorisms, is maybe a little bit too compressed. You know, there are other things to say about that, but I think it speaks a certain truth as well. You know, for as long as we're kind of caught up in our own sense of ego identity, we're always going to be unhappy.
Sorry, can you just say a little bit more about this critical point?
The gap. Yeah, we're going to get the telescope out, and now we're going to have a closer look at what is happening. Okay, so here is the gap. Here is feeling. Here's vajana. Typically, the kind of momentum of our habits, our personality, our personality is our psychology. You know, our psychology is our personality. Yeah. And it is our ethical behaviour. They're all the same thing, aren't they? If there's someone that you know who's always very generous, you know, they've got a very generous personality. Yeah. Usually our momentum just kind of carries us straight over, and we don't even really notice that there's a gap. And the reason that we tend to shoot over the top and just carry on around in the same old, is that actually what is in the gap is difficult. It is those uncomfortable feelings that Mariangela and Thomas were describing, which is dukkha. So that's the Buddhist description of the sense of unsatisfactoriness, something's not right, the sense of lack, and it's also the poisons. So you know, it's our kind of greed, hatred, and delusion, which we understand are the things that kind of drive the wheel round. So. When we're sufficiently mindful and we kind of slow down and that gap starts to open up, then you know, we're having to kind of come into relationship with some of these difficult feelings. So I drew this and I said to Joseph, what do you think that is? And he said,
fertile ground.
Fertile ground, which is great. Because actually, when I drawn it, I thought, what I'm drawing is a pile of shit.
I know that.
And of course. But, yes.
That's our ground, mate.
But, of course, that is it. Because we dig in. This is what happens in the gap. When we stop, you know, when we don't just carry up, do our usual reactive way of operating, if we stop and start to take responsibility for our own shit, then actually it becomes fertile ground. So we're digging in the shit and we're creating a lovely, not febrile, what's the word? Of a soil, friable. A friable soil by digging in all this organic matter, which stinks. It stinks, but it's a microbiome. Yeah.
Craving, does that mean like craving a substance, or can it be craving like something emotional, or what is it? Both, and is that what distracts you from going down?
Yeah, well, it's like we're having a feeling here that maybe is uncomfortable, and our tendency, well, if the feeling here is uncomfortable, our tendency is we're going to want to crave something that's going to take that discomfort away. So yes, I mean it can be substances, but it can also be it can be our behaviours as well. So typically, it's kind of we start to blame other people, or we feel sorry for ourselves. So blame, self-pity, and distraction are understood to be the three kind of highly likely ways that we're gonna not feel what we don't want to feel. If this is a pleasant feeling, then we're just gonna want more of it, probably. So here, obviously, kind awareness to ourselves is absolutely essential. Like I said, a lot of our unskillfulness is towards ourselves in the first place. But also, if we've hurt others, or if we haven't done what we can to stay in relationship with people, that's going to weigh heavy on our hearts, and that's not always an easy place to be. I was talking to a body therapist the other day, and he was saying he says how important he thinks it is for us to establish a really kind of good sense of our base and our lower part of our body before we kind of start to open the heart, because that's you need a lot of support for the heart to open. And if we can learn to sit with ourselves in this place and come into stillness, be kind to ourselves in that stillness, then faith, confidence, or shraddha can start to develop. So we actually start to believe that these practices work, and I can do them. Yeah, and I think Lilamani, we had a couple of weeks on Shraddha in this series. So yeah, so and Shraddha is the first step on that spiral path that we talked about. Freedom from Pramodya. This the freedom from remorse that we're talking about is the second stage. Yeah, so that's the second step on the spiral path. I was talking with Ratna Prabhu earlier about it. It's kind of like feels like it's sort of like as we start to get a bit more kind of wind under our wings in terms of our spiritual practice, start to gain more kind of sense of confidence and the heart starts to open. It's almost like we naturally kind of start to come into relationship with some of our unethical behaviour in the past, and then it kind of starts to burn off a bit, kind of like it's like coming up through the clouds, I think. And then, yeah. we reach a point where at least there's some sense of freedom from remorse. Interestingly, the next step on the path is rapture. Rapture. So that's a state of joy in the body. So it's a very strong somatic experience that freedom of remorse can lead to, a real kind of opening up of the delight body. I don't know if people have experienced that in meditation, but it's very it's a real boon. Okay, so I think that's really all I wanted to say in the area, but hopefully that's raised some questions. So maybe just let's just for a moment just reflect maybe on maybe just don't overdo it, but just something that you've done in your lives that you now feel some regret around. So in Buddhism, in part of our ethical practice is the practice of confession. So I think if you've got any kind of Catholic background, then that's probably ringing alarm bells. There's an appreciation that actually sharing with another a sense of regret can, if that's met in a kind way, that can actually help to. Release us from some of that that charge. So I'm just going to invite us to pair up. So can I ask you to pair up and then two and you two. Okay, we've got a three there. So yeah, just Thomas. So I think you're with him. So just for a couple of minutes. Tell the other person what it is that came to you. And so, thank you for joining in. Anyone experiencing any freedom as a result of this brief, this brief sharing?
Well, some memories up for me, just in relation to hearing your perspective, because I didn't get around to me sharing what came up for me around remorse, but nonetheless, what you shared was helpful for me. Just to listen and to have the privilege of you being silent and candid, but also just in what it triggered in me, in terms of just the recognition of relationships and connections with people, and just how delicate and intricate things often are, and how often stuff that occurs can have lots of subtexts, and just being aware of that kind of thing in relationships and connections with people, because otherwise stuff can be said or one can behave in ways which can actually affect us, me or somebody else detrimentally. So it was useful. And the stuff around remorse and regret for me, I'm not at a point where I don't regret the past or the same time, I don't want to completely shut the door on it, because I know that I learn a lot from my past and from the experiences that I've had. And
so does it make sense to you that remorse can be the natural educator of the heart?
Yeah, well, you know, we went for that walk. I don't want to monopolise the time or labour the point, but Balasamani and I went for a walk before the class, and I spoke to you about some aspects of my experience over the weekend and how definitely some emotions got evoked for me that were quite deep, connected to my heart centre, and how you quite accurately said that there was remorse in there in relation to the experience that I shared with you, and how that was a recognition of some kind of disparity in relation to sometimes the way that I have behaved, and how that's not in complete concord with sort of that sweet and more vulnerable part of me, and that more open receptive part of me, and it's because of fear, and maybe because of, you know, being defensive, and also because of the self-saboteur, because of the way that you so eloquently depicted that, you know, the stuff around difficulty with sitting with the feelings and sometimes wanting to get away from it, you know.
And how about for you, Richard? Was it that sense of, did you get any sense of lightness from the, any plamodia arising?
Well, I got very much the thing about the educating the heart.
Good, yeah.
There was clarity.
Okay.
I don't know if it was lightness. There's clarity, and it definitely educates the heart.
Anyone else have any after effects? Or in the moment effects?
It's definitely changes the feeling to share it. To have the affirmation of another human being, possibly recognising but just witnessing it.
Well, one thing I like about it is that it brings understanding if you share it, and so you think, oh yes, well that really makes sense, and with that comes acceptance, which is, I think, terribly important, that you don't go around accusing yourself of being such a dreadful person.
And can you understand so how that might support your meditation practice?
Oh, yes.
could you say a little more about that?
Well, in my case, if I'm not agitating against myself and others, I can relax into meditation much better and reach another level, completely different level.
I can relate to what you were saying about restlessness and anxiety. Anxiety seems to be associated, as you were saying, with avoiding something.
Mm.
And often, you know, just these wandering... Sometimes you just get wandering thoughts that are fairly neutral things in meditation getting in the way, but sometimes there's a bit more... There's like an emotional tinge to those wandering thoughts. There's a sort of a slight... There's a tension there, isn't there?
Mm.
And then I do start to suspect maybe there's something I'm avoiding.
Mm.
And so the restlessness and anxiety as a hindrance to meditation does seem to be connected with my how happy I am with myself and the way I'm living and the way I'm treating people and so on.
Mm.
That did make sense to me.
So yeah, if anxiety is something that comes up for us a lot in our meditation practice, well, just generally in our lives, yeah, I think at some point it can be useful to just sort of ask ourselves, you know, well, what's underneath that? Is there some kind of something in our lives that isn't quite in? I'm not sure how Joseph put it, but something in that's not in. What was the word he used?
Concord.
well, concord, yeah, does it, yeah, some kind of disparity was the word you used, yeah, between our lived behaviour and our ideals. And obviously, sometimes that's not that comfortable to do, is it?
It's our self-image, isn't it, really?
Self-image.
It's our self-image. It's how we think we should be.
Okay.
It's not the same as what actually is going on.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's really uncomfortable, isn't it, when you have a strong sense of how you ought to be. I'm not saying that's, you know, I mean, it's a strange thing, because ethically, we tend to think of self-image as being a good work, a kind of a tool for good behaviour, say. You know, I'm a good person, so I will behave like that.
Okay.
But we're talking about something else here. Not really. We're talking about something much deeper.
Okay. Carry on, yeah.
So it's not about self-image. It's actually about just being with whatever it is.
Okay. Yeah.
And that is the ethical thing. Accepting oneself as one is in that moment is the kind thing to do, and that is ethical, to be kind to oneself in that moment.
Sure, yeah, there's that. But yes, I suppose, but yeah, if part of what we're experiencing in the moment is remorse, that is because, yeah, somehow our aspirations, we've fallen short of them. Yeah, so I think that both elements can be in play. I think the dangerous, you know, the thing we have to watch out for is the kind of self-recrimination.
Isn't that a natural thing that would happen?
There is a danger, yes.
Your own self-loathing.
Yeah.
Your own regret, like feeling guilty.
Yeah.
So how do you sit with it without it becoming like a...
Well, that's, in a way, that's part of the confession practice, or the kind of sharing practice, is, you know, because, yeah, often we have a kind of distorted view of our behaviour. There's one model that suggests that we're prone either to alienation or inflation. So either we're better than we think we're better than we are, or we think we're worse than we are, or both. Yeah. So alienation and inflation. So yeah, depending kind of maybe what time of day it is.
Or who you're with,
or, you know, where you're swinging on the spectrum at any minute. But yes, it is. You're quite right. It's a kind of trap that we can get caught up in here. Yeah. So yes, you rather than kind of digging the shit in, you're just. Yeah, this smells disgusting. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's one of the interesting things about sharing. The Buddhist term for it literally means disclosure,
yeah,
rather than confession, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So simply, so look, and then there are two effects from that. One of them is often you think it's not such a big deal, actually.
Yeah.
And the other person says, oh, yeah, I do that as well, yeah. And you think, oh, really? Other it's just me.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is it's a little bit more difficult to avoid the reality of it. And therefore, to continue the habit is funnily difficult. So if I don't talk about it at all, on the one hand, I can sort of hate myself for having that habit. And on the other hand, the habit just carries on.
Mm.
So I carry on that self-loathing. But a little bit of sharing, a little bit of disclosure, and if it's with a kind person, you think, oh yeah, it's not such a big deal, but am I going to carry on? You know, are they going to say next week, are you still doing that? But you told me about that last week, and you said how you really didn't want to do that. Why are you still doing that? So I think, there's two sides to it. It's interesting.
Can we have the chance to reverse? Because when you rang the bell, I thought, swap, and then it wasn't. It was like the end.
So the other person
to talk. Some of us didn't have the chance to reverse it. I don't know if there's time.
We'll end with that. So yeah, that in a way not being afraid of our remorse, recognizing it as this sort of what's called the natural educator of the heart. It's kind of it's how we actually develop conscience in a way. So sort of trusting that we have a sort of, in a way, intuitively we kind of know what's right. I think, you know, the heart knows the truth, and sort of trusting that faculty, in a way, that intuitive faculty, without, yeah, as you say, kind of finding ourselves ending up in self-loathing and recrimination, which just, you know, just kind of. That's not the spiral path, you know. That's just grinding the wheel a bit further. So, you know, which is why it's so important that we include kindness in our mindfulness. I hope you've heard that message here at the centre, you know, that the loving kindness practice and the mindfulness of breathing practice, you know, they really are complementary practices, and I think ideally. They kind of start to co, you know, they start to sort of weave into each other. Before we get some people get the chance to share their moment of regret, any last things anyone would like to ask or reflect. So does it make this idea of the gap as the working ground of the spiritual life? Yeah, is that kind of have people got
really
that?
Really nice drawing.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, and just that's the whole purpose of mindfulness is to open up that gap. You know, give us the ability to slow down long enough to be able to sit in the gap and breathe. And there's this wonderful thing that actually so many of the difficult feelings that we have, if we just sort of sit still with them, they just dissolve. And the kind of, you know, we have so much fear around feeling these things. And a lot of them are early fears. But actually, you know, if we do actually allow ourselves just to sit with them, hey, it's, you know, they're often not as big as we think they are. It's like the Wizard of Oz, you know. We see actually the little guy behind all this big whoa, is just something. I don't know what I'm doing. I am Oz. Yeah. Get over it, Marianne.
No, it's just when it's a feeling. It's just a feeling. It's when you start thinking about it, you start turning that feeling into a bigger thing.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as it's a feeling, it could be just. It's unpleasant,
yeah.
But it's not going to become anything more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone said to me, feelings are all very well. Feelings are like ferrets. They're interesting to watch, but you wouldn't want to base your life on them.